You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Today's show is the first part of a series entitled Imaging the Us, an exploration of autobiographical writings, which is a collaboration between Bookworm and the Getty Center for the History of Art and the Humanities. This collaboration looks at the relationship between autobiographical writings, memory, and the articulation of an us. Today I have Sandra Cisneros here. She's a poet and fiction writer, and her books include The House on Mango Street, Loose Woman, My Wicked, Wicked Ways, and Woman Hollering Creek. We're going to talk a little bit about the role of memory in writing. Sandra, do you find that autobiography is the significant springboard to your writing?
Well, you know, people assume that everything I write is autobiographical. And when they assume that, in some ways, it's almost as if I've done my job because I've convinced them that it seems so true and so real that they can't just assume it happened to me. I do use my life as a canvas, so to speak, but I don't want to limit myself with just my life when there are so many other lives around me that I'm spying on or have access to, privy to some information through people telling me stories. And then there's your imagination, too. If you only base it on your life, you've cut off this jet blood of other ideas that might come to you.
Do you feel that autobiographical writing can help create a cultural identity? Do you look at your work as being a potential role model or former of community?
Well, you know, I think that that's a frightening thing to think about. I mean, you know, I probably couldn't write anything if I thought about it when I was writing it. Mm-hmm. But I do have to admit that you're probably right about that. That I'm creating a kind of a text that will be used and looked at as a role model. Certainly, I think when I begin a piece of writing, I try not to think too much of, you know, how it's going to be read, and I'm much more concerned with creating the piece of art. But on the other hand, to answer your question, I'm very much concerned about shaping and reshaping stories or instructing or changing the way people think. So on the one hand, you know, you have to be a little bit less self-conscious about constructing the art, but on the other hand, I'm very much concerned that I'm working to fill voids where there have been voids. I think about books I didn't get when I was growing up that could have changed my life. I think about writing a text that might save my student's life or that might help to confirm some 11-year-old's life because, you know, she hasn't seen herself in a book. So there's a lot of things I suppose I'm aware of through my having lived a life without those texts. Yes.
Do you regard yourself as the voice of a group of the Chicana child or family? Do you feel that you are a channel of a group consciousness?
You know, Michael, when I began, I really felt so powerless to do anything to change anyone's life. I could hardly change my own life, you know. And I was just out there doing my community work, my volunteer work, and my paid job, which was working with youth in the Latino community. And my writing was something that I did because I was being paid to teach them literacy skills. But I didn't see how what I love to do, writing poetry and stories, was going to save anyone's life but my own. And now it's just amazing to see the resonance of something one does so privately and sometimes at a moment of great and extreme despair and powerlessness now come forth and make the full circle from the community where I listened to those tales. And now it's a text used in that very school where I first gathered those stories and is doing the work for me that I never dreamed a story could do. Now I've forgotten the question.
The idea of channeling a group identity.
Yeah, you know, when I was younger, I guess I didn't realize the power literature could have, because the kind of literature I saw was very self-serving. It didn't seem to serve my community or address my community's needs. Now at 40, I'm realizing the incredible power a story has, a poem, let alone a book, you know, to move someone, to validate someone's life, to save someone from, you know, the beatings that life gives you. And I'm much more conscious of writing the stories now and sending them out there for people on I may never meet.
You know, I was speaking recently to a Native American writer, Greg Saras, who mentioned to me the astonishingly disheartening literacy rates on the reservation. And he was, in fact, telling me that although one doesn't give up hope, he knew ultimately that he is writing for an audience who will never be able to read his work.
That's right. And sometimes, you know, never will be able to buy your book. That's why it's so important that the word go out there orally on a radio, or that in a textbook, you know, in a grade school where perhaps a child will never, who never owned a book and will never own a book beyond the one he borrows in school. You know, that story is there for the real purpose that storytelling was there, you know, to instruct, guide, and save a life. And it's more important for me sometime that the story get told or even get repeated or shared. I don't really care. And of course, my publishers won't like this if, you know, those young children buy the book as much as that they hear the story and the story give them some sense of self-worth and a reason to be, you know?
Could you, I know, for instance, your story, 11, has been much anthologized, and you've mentioned that the appearances have been everywhere from children's anthologies to modern maturity. Could you speak about the individual incident and the process, the memory, and then the process of shaping it?
Yeah, I always talk to young people, and using, when I do my presentations in the school, I talk about that story, 11. It's a good story for any age, but it's especially a wonderful story to share with young people so they can see the process of writing a story. 11 was actually written while I was living in my brother's house, and I was penniless, and he was supporting me during my periods in which I was frustrated having to have a day job and needed some time to write. So my brother and sister-in-law gave me an open door to their home. Anytime I wanted to live with them, they would support me. They were my Medicis from several periods. And so during that time, I felt a little embarrassed about my brother, who was just starting his practice. He's a physician. And, you know, he had a lot of bills, and yet he was paying for everything for me. And I thought I should earn some money in some way. And Children's Press wrote to me. They had seen House on Manga Street, and though children loved it, they knew I had not written it for children, but I had a wonderful perception of the children's world. Would I write a short story for children? Well, seeing as how I didn't have any money, I said, coming right up. And I wrote this story. I remember closing myself in the bedroom after I had watched my telenovelas. I closed myself up in the bedroom, and I said, okay, a lot of coffee. My sister-in-law always supplied me lots of coffee, very supportive. I said, okay, now I'm going to write that story. Which story do I write? And as always, what I write about are the things that I can't forget, the emotions that are there even when I shut my eyes. You know, that I can see them clear when I shut my eyes. Even when I don't want to think about them, they come back. So I took a memory of something that happened to me when I was 8 years old, about a sweater that was in the coat room for a long time, very raggedy and old. It was a white sweater or a pink sweater. I can't remember which. I know it was not red. And teacher asked whose was it, and someone said they thought that they had seen me wearing it after no one claimed it. And this made me especially ashamed because the sweater was raggedy, and of everyone in the class, I didn't realize that I looked raggedy until that moment, and that the teacher said, oh, yes, it's yours. I saw you wear it once. Humiliated me because, of course, I was one of the poorer children in the class. But that sweater for me was a symbol of teacher and everyone else saying, you're about as worthless as that sweater. It was a horrible moment when you're a child and you know you're right, but you can't convince anyone, especially since I was shy and one of those students that never spoke unless spoken to. So this was a great injustice. Sweater was put on my desk. Since I had no way to rebel or articulate my rage, what I did is I touched it with the ruler and pushed it to the corner of my desk. And I thought, well, you will be here, but I don't have to touch you. And I ignored it all day. Eventually, the real owner, some dizzy child said, oh, yeah, that's mine, and took it and claimed it later in the day. But by then, the damage had been done. I had been marked as that ugly sweater. And it did it left a terrible emotional scar about how I was perceived by the white classroom and this white instructor as a Mexican person, because it wasn't just about class. It was also about color. Now, when I took that story and wrote about it, I had also just written a poem about turning 30 and falling in love. And I remember in the poem there was a line saying, I'm 30, but I feel goofy like sixth grader. I'm 30, I'm 29, 28, 27, 26, clear down to one. And I thought, isn't that how growing up is? We are all the ages, like a tree trunk or like a wooden doll, but people only see the outside. And whereas in our hearts, we're all these ages at different times, depending on whether we're frightened or scared or feeling sad. So I took the two ideas and wrote a story about someone who's 11. I needed her to be a little bit older so that I could articulate some things that an 8-year-old cannot say. And I decided to make it her birthday because, you know, it's so much worse when things happen on your birthday as opposed to any other day. It would be more tragic. And you know, that accident of placing it on her birthday was very good because not only could you talk about all the ages, you know, but you could also talk about growing up and experience of growing older. So then I decided to change details. Let's make the sweater red so it really is some eyesore there, an unforgettable blot. And let's change the teacher from a nun to a lay teacher. We have lots of horrible nun stories. That's too much. Let's just do a teacher. And all right, let's make her have to put the sweater on. And on, I had to invent what my mind could not remember. And this is what an author does. You make up the smell of the sweater. It was so terrible, it smelled like cottage cheese. In real life, I don't remember what the sweater smelled like. And I can't even remember the exact color. But the writer knows, and the writer knows to invent and to fill in all the gaps of memory. And, of course, you know, the story is a story now that all children want to read, and they always claim, they always ask me to please read that story. But the humor is that once I finished the story and sent it off to this Boston press, they rejected it because they said it wasn't for children.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there is something about the writing of that story as well, that growing sense of shame that the sweater represents, and one's moment of knowing that, yes, this story is making me small again.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that feeling very well. What do you suppose is the relationship of memory and fiction to pain? Does it heal it? Does it alter it?
I think that there are so many memories that we can't forget, you know, even if we try. And it's the ones that we can't forget, especially the ones we are trying to forget, that are so easy for me to write about, that have great deal of power. They have a great deal of power. Right in writing about that story, that I couldn't even confess to my mother or my brothers that this had happened to me that day, this humiliation. In writing it, I was able to transform that shame into something else. I could go beyond the shame, and the story could become very clear so I could see what it was that had really happened to me. And now, you know, it's the story something else now. I can't remember which part of the story I made up and which parts are invented now, because the story has substituted the memory. And it happens a lot to me now. You know, I'll write the story so well that I convince myself that my version is the true story.
Well, it's very interesting. When you were talking to me, as you imagined the sweater as being white, perhaps, or pink, you closed your eyes to visualize that original sweater. But when you were telling about making it red, your eyes were wide open.
Yeah.
What stimulates, what does the process of memory feel like for
you?
Well,
what I try to do is I use the senses that are the most accurate. The eyes are the least accurate, the sight.
Really?
For me. Uh-huh. And I think this is proven true. I really would hate to have eyewitnesses say anything because, you know, we just change things around. Especially if I'm a witness to things, I always change things around as a writer. But I think the most ancestral and ancient sense is the sense of smell. And so sometimes when the memory is fuzzy, I'll begin with sense of smell. Even if I don't remember, as I said in this case, the smell, I will invent from there. let's begin with smell. If we don't remember, let's make it up. And that will pull other details that are in the unconscious. That's usually sense of smell and sense of taste for me are the most difficult senses to write about, and I always admire writers who are able to do that well. Colette, for example, so wonderful in dealing with those two senses. And I try to write using those senses because they're the ones that get easily ignored and they're the most difficult.
Well, just as an example, what does your childhood smell like? Can you say?
Yes. Yes, I do. And I think we can remember old parts of our past, ancient parts of our past, by going through smell. And to me, what I smell is the house, you know, the smells of hallways where one sought refuge as a child. We always lived in apartment buildings, you know, sometimes on top of a storefront or these big three-story buildings, and hallways and the smell of them being, you know, wooden stairs being cleaned with Lysol, and that damp smell of the wood and the Lysol. I think about that.
Now, when you're attempting to give us that, for instance, Joyce famously and astonishingly says of it, the scrotum-tightening sea, or later the snot-green sea, what does the wording process involve?
In remembering the
smell? Once you've got the memory of the smell and you're about to transform, for instance, a sweater smelling like cottage cheese doesn't come immediately, but you know exactly, you know, what's going on, and all sorts of, you know, the horribleness of the sweater and the curdiness of cottage cheese start swapping.
Well, you know, I don't know. I've never thought about that. That's a good point, a good question. I think for me, because Spanish is so much a part of my language, sometimes the syntax is sounds a little weird in English, but if you translated it, it would sound like Spanish. So a lot of times for me, some of the things that are coming through is the Spanish language.
That's very interesting.
Because I grew up with my father, who's Spanish. His Spanish is his first language, and with my mother, whose Spanish is her second language. And so I always grew up with the two languages, speaking to one person in one language and to the other parent in another language.
Oh, that's so interesting, because what you see always requires words, because the eye goes to the brain. But what you smell, you can smell in any language at all or in no language.
Yes, that's true, but I think that each language has its own sensibilidad, no sensibility. And I know sometimes that some of the things that I've come up with have come from, you know, my Mexican Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either from the way of looking, the Mexican Spanish's way is its way of looking at the world in a different way, of looking at objects, neuter objects, in a different way.
What kinds of things, or are there things, that you choose or even insist on misremembering?
That's a good one. I got it. Do I have to answer that in 5 seconds?
Oh, no. You can
I take my time to think, what do I choose to misremember? Wow, that's a good question, Michael. I'm going to think about this, wake up in the middle of the night or on my plane, say, I should have said that. I think what I'm misremembering is what I'm writing about now, the novel I'm working on. I want to know what it was like before I was born and when I was in my mother's belly and when I was in my grandmother's blood and when I was dust floating around in my great-grandfather's blood. I want to go backwards to the story because who I am is made up of so many people in different parts of the world. So much blood from Northern Africa and from Spain and from Latin America and who knows where else that have made me. So the story doesn't begin with me. It begins before I was born, when I was dirt. As we were children, when we talked about before our time, we would begin the story when I was dirt, meaning when I was dust. And I want to write from when I was dirt, when I was just this little speck of dust floating around in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
I want to misremember it.
Well, that's very interesting to me, because I have to tell you that there were moments in my childhood where, you know, as you know, what you can be teased for when you're a child is limitless.
Oh, yes.
It's not just ethnicity, it's everything. And
yes.
So, of course, I mean, you know, I named my show Bookworm in the same way that, you know, okay, you're going to call me Bookworm. Well, I'll take that identity and I'll show you that there are pleasures and dreams and things that I have access to because of my bookwormness, you know.
Yes.
But the things that I misremember are the real nightmares of persecution, you know, that came, you know, that I can't focus on completely and yet formed me.
Yes. And I think, too, for me, you know, in the kind of, there's a pre-Columbian way of thinking that you're connected to everything that comes after you and before you. And I can't tell a simple story, so I really want to misremember so that I can create and use my imagination and what little bit I have. And fortunately, in my family, nobody tells you anything straight. Everyone lies and embellishes. We have a family of great storytellers. I think it's being Mexican. They all want to quedar bien. They want you to like them, so they kind of lie a little bit. And I want to misremember the past so that I can create, you know, this great cloth of which I'm a little fiber of.
Mm. Did you have secret stories? Like you mention your brothers and the Swan Keepers, and you remember Grimm's fairy tales in one of your poems in which the brothers are returned to being human who've been turned into swans, and one of them is turned back too soon and still has the left wing of a swan instead of an arm. Do you have secret stories that become for you the stories of family?
I think for me, as a young girl, fairy tales were such a part of my life, and I love them still. They're still like Andersen, Hans Christian Andersen is one of my favorite authors still now. So I'm always looking at those metaphors as part of my own mythology. The Snow Queen is a story I'm very close to, and I keep seeing that as a metaphor for ways in which I've been blinded by, you know, evils in the world that sets a little mirror, a little sliver of an evil mirror in your eye, and doesn't allow you to see clearly. And only when you're able to cry are you able to wash it out. I think the process of writing is that, don't you think?
Absolutely.
That writing allows us to cry and to lose that vision that we had that has distorted our life and pained us, and finally to see clearly. But it's only through writing that we can transform our vision, you know, and our anger and pain into some clarity and wisdom.
Are there places where fairy tales, which after all are the result of European migration, that fairy tales come from certain places. Are there points where Mexican folk tales and fairy tales intermesh?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there are very many similar tales throughout the world. I think Joseph Campbell was very good at drawing them all together, that there seems to be certain motifs that are repeated in folk tales and in mythology of cultures. The fairy tales I'm close to because I know that they were passed on by women. They were collected by men and sometimes transformed into something else or invented and reinvented by men. But the ones that told them and retold them were women. The brothers Grimm collected them. The best storyteller was a housewife, this little woman who told tales and was a very good storyteller. And so I feel like I'm part of that tradition of women telling oral tales, that I'm setting down these voices to paper, but I'm still part of a tradition that is working orally. And as an oral tale, then it's important you repeat a story that serves the community, and when it no longer serves the community, it dies out because people no longer remember it, you see.
Well, what I'm remembering in particular, my father, in fact, told us stories, but because we were Russians of Russian descent, he told the story of Peter Pan. I doubt he would even remember this as being the story of Petrushka Pan. And Never Never Land was like something behind the Iron Curtain, because he was telling me the story in the 50s where that was the American conception of Russia. So all these parts of being a Russian Jew entered his telling of the story that was otherwise, you know, European, Irish, James M. Barrie, Scottish, all of the things got dyed through his sensibility. Were stories told to you in that way?
Well, my mom was a good storyteller. She invented things. They were kind of instructional, and she did take some stories and tell us some cultural stories that were meant to modify and control our wildness, you know, I suppose. But I also was, you know, part of my tradition was not just these stories meant to modify women's behavior, but the stories of the saints were part of my upbringing.
Yes.
And aren't they wild?
We didn't have them, but I can imagine.
But, you know, I went to these schools that, you didn't have very much to pick from, very poor schools, and so you had to read about, you know, Song of Bernadette, or you had to read Life of the Saints, or, you know, and I read all of these books, and so they were part of, you know, they were as gruesome as the, you know, mythology and fairy tales, but they were all part of that mythology of myself, my personal mythology.
And so you, in your own poetry, construct the life almost of an anti-saint.
I do have to say I've kind of invented that persona, and now bookstores have this little cutout of me,
really?
Loose woman, and it says, it's a quote that's taken from the Boston Globe. It's sexy, passionate, hot as chili peppers. And when I opened up this little paper doll of me and saw these quotes, it meant the book, but of course it looks like it means me because it's my picture. I said, oh my God, what have I created? Some part of me was delighted and some part of me was horrified, but mainly I was amused and I laughed and I thought, I have succeeded in inventing myself. And as the poem says, I'm the woman of myth and bullshit. True, I authored most of it.
I am talking, have been talking to Sandra Cisneros on the subject of memory, autobiography, stories, and fiction. She is the author of Loose Woman, published recently in paperback from Vintage, My Wicked, Wicked Ways in hardcover from Knopf, also in paperback from Third Woman, The House on Mango Street, published both in English and Spanish by Vintage, and Woman Hollering Creek. Thank you for being with us
today.
Thank
you, Michael. Lots of fun talking to you.
I love talking to you, too. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineers for this show were Scott Fritz and Theo Mandel. Special thanks to Roberto Bedoya of the Getty Center. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.